Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read, delighted to welcome you to another edition of our program. Tonight, our writer reader is Gary Hill. He's going to be reading a story called There's No One Now at Manubi, Only Flies. Here's Gary.
There's no one now at Manubi, only flies. Elaborate designs of the great water snake covered the nearly naked body of the club as she sat alone in the dry desert sun. The sacred formal designs were bright red, stark white, and black, covering her completely. She sat back on her heels with her legs underneath her, next to a group of 34 small mounds of sand. The club's hair tumbled down as far as her shoulders, falling across the meticulous body designs in large, rolling, light brown curls. She had been sitting still, unmoving for hours, as a bright sun blasted the hard desert, scorching everything that lived, drying out everything that lay beneath it. Dust had settled on her shoulders, arms, her legs. Her lips were dry, cracked, parched. Her voice was weak as she sat immobile, chanting over and over in a painful whisper, "Water is coming." The newcomers arrived 3 days ago. They carried burning gum leaves to frighten night spirits. They knew that the camp sorcerer would kill them before they reached camp if he thought they were cannibalistic night spirits. So they made the familiar noise of clapping their spear throwers together instead of making the low whistling sound in the bush that night spirits made. Stone Age clubs, shields that contain one half of the warrior's souls, spears accurate up to 40 meters, spear throwers and double-edged stone knives were ready to attack them. Until the camp warriors recognize relatives coming. They recognize Pejant Jajera speaking fellows, recognize those who had the word. Men separated from the women as they begin to talk. One of the new group said, "We've been coming looking for water. We've been coming for days. There is no water here, but what we have we will share. This water hole is dry. Tomorrow we go to Partjar. Holy Partjar always has water. You can come with us and we will all have plenty of water." The snake-owned water holes are holy, for without them all life is over. After some discussion, both groups made the decision to go to the water hole at Partjar, and the men began to relax. The talk turned to the quality of spear wood, to hunting. Boys played with a lizard, and suddenly one of them laughed, tearing off the lizard's leg. Both children and men laughed at this as the meeting broke up, as men urinated where they were, as they went to sleep in lean-to shelters. That was 3 days ago. The club chanted weakly without sound, but she sat straight, her face set, diamond hard, determined. The devastating dry heat reached its afternoon peak. Waves of hot, desiccating wind swept through the desert, penetrating everything. She meditated near tire tracks made earlier that morning. Of all her tribe, of all her people, the club had faith that they would be saved. She alone waited, patient, fearless in the sun. She waited, using all her magic, all her power, all her formidable strength to bring water and save her tribe. Her face stern, unyielding as she chanted, "Water is coming." No water the next morning and no fresh fruit. Nothing but seed cake. which is a fruit ground into paste with seeds and grit, then shaped into a child's hand-sized ball. That was their only food. The dry heat, in a manner that is contrary to what might be expected, conditions the desert people to need more water than non-desert dwellers. So their need for water was great. They came from their lean-to shelters in the morning and prepared to leave. There was little to carry. So the group of 35 nomads were on their way to Potjar early in the morning. Warriors and hunters were on the lookout for the large emu bird, for kangaroos, for lizards. Women in bark sandals had their eyes open for edible plants. Temperatures were already at 90 degrees Fahrenheit and climbing as the tribe members began their quest for water. They came to a sacred cave where the people stored holy artifacts. The women and children walked away far from the desert cave, but one woman remained. The newcomers looked at her and yelled, "Go off now! Sacred things are coming, things that make a woman crazy. Things that kill a woman if she sees him. Go far away." The woman replied, "I am the club, and I will stay." She stood upright, poised, self-confident, unafraid. One of the men said, "You're crazy already." And he advanced on her, drawing his knife to kill her. He knew she must be crazy, because a woman who has looked at or touched a sacred object belonging to the men will either die or go insane immediately. There were no exceptions. A woman forfeits her life just by glancing at a sacred object. Her relatives in such cases cannot avenge her death. The man advancing did not have any alternative in mind. He was advancing to kill her. "Wait," cried the club's tribesman. "The club is our sorcerer." "What?" said the newcomer. "I've never heard of such things. It's not possible. For she is a woman with breasts. You must be crazy. Just like she is, maybe we will kill you too." "Ha!" said the tribesman. "We'll make this a killing ground for you." They drew their weapons. An old man stepped between the two groups, talking to the newcomers as he came. "Stop. We know it has not happened before. We know women have never been sorcerers, but the world is not what it was. Everything under the great sun changes. The desert itself is always shifting, changing everything. Have you been to Manubi? It was a great place, a home of a proud people. People there gave up. They just gave up. They moved. They all moved to the mission. They wear clothes, live in wood houses, never go into the desert, and their children cannot speak. The children do not have the word. They speak only the foreign tongue of the English. And now those people are heartsick for this country, for Manubi. Now there's no one left of Manubi, only flies. This one," pointing to the club, "has gained power through long years of preparation and training, and she guides us in all the old traditions. She's had to work harder, to know more than any man. She never quits, never gives up. She knows the rituals, leads in ceremonies, makes rain. She foretells the future, tells whenever people are getting ready to die, heals the sick and fights off evil sorcery coming from night spirits and other tribes." The club walked slowly forward and, reaching into her bag, quickly pulled out pointing bones. She held 6 bones in all, each bone from a forearm of a dead sorcerer, each bone decorated beautifully with mysterious carvings. 5 bones magically tied together with human hair, and at the end of a 1-meter hair rope, the 6th bone The club looked around, checking her position, softly saying, "The sun is in back of me. There is no water hole in front of me." The newcomers became frightened at these ritualistic words. Bone pointing could kill you, cause sickness or death, even at a great distance. The curse that came with it was as deadly as the bones. So there was good reason for fear. Before the club began the song, before she pointed the bones, before she asked the spirit to curse her enemies, the newcomers laid down their weapons, stepping back respectfully. The club turned and put away her pointing bones casually, as if nothing had occurred. The men also acted as if nothing had happened. That was 2 days ago. The club seemed not to notice the hard, bright heat as she sat alone, brave in the deadly sun, her soft hair now tumbling over her bent forehead as her strength began to fade. As the constant sun began to bend its crushing, burning strength against the dusty, shifting desert, her skin ached from the bright heat. Still, she would not give in. She would not yield. She touched the circles painted on her breast and stomach. She cupped her hands into fists and beat them into the ground in time as she chanted, soundless now, her voice gone. "Water is coming, coming." Waves of heat reflected off the quartz, the silica, the hot dust, the dry wind, and the burning rock. All life seemed to have ceased. The men disappeared into the sacred cave, kneeling, wailing loudly for 5 minutes. The wailing came to a stop. Then the oldest tribesman brought out a sacred board, taking it to the men, who regarded the board with awe. The club, unnoticed till then, came forward. Her body mysteriously painted in 3 white, black, and red circles, connected in a V design, her head painted red with a white stripe like a headband, painted on her forehead. She touched the sacred board and danced, hopping stiffly with her head and arms limp, singing softly as she danced. "Bring us rain, Tometuka, bring us rain, woman of the monsoon rains. Bring us rain, daughter of the frog woman, daughter of Quark Quark, bring us rain. Bring us rain, Tometuka, bring us rain." The dance, the song, the ritual was surprisingly brief. But as soon as the sacred board had been returned to its place by the old man, a dark, heavy rain cloud appeared like magic directly overhead. The men cheered, giving thanks to the great snake. But the club did not cheer. She was not happy. The entire tribe and the newcomers, too, began following the dark rain cloud. It was so close, so heavy. Soon, they thought, it would be raining. And in anticipation, the tribe walked with lifted hearts, with lighter steps, with renewed hope. But the club did not smile. She said instead, "This cloud will bring you to your graves." She walked slow, clutching her bag of sacred objects that hung round her neck, looking at the rain cloud through an old monocle. No one had listened when she said, "We should keep going on to Potjar." The other women sang and smiled. The men laughed, showing the gaps of missing front teeth knocked out during the rites of manhood. They shook their penises at each other, showing the scars, the penile wounds, those badges of ritual status and personal courage. Without the scars, it would be impossible to become a socially adult male. These adults walked proud, walking easily over the desert. They followed the rain cloud until night, and then sent trackers to watch it while they slept. They went after the trackers before first light, catching up with him as daybreak came. Women were leaving the group from time to time looking for food. The club went with them, for even a sorceress must look for food. But neither men nor women found food. All through the hot morning they followed the rain cloud, their moods more sober now, but still cheerful, still full of smiles and laughter. Walking, they saw the sky grow dark beneath the rain cloud. Running, they saw the rain cloud become smaller, lighter. Too late, they saw the rain cloud pour its water into the dry sands like an evil spirit before they could get to it. The great snake gave no water. All around them, the earth felt hot and dry, and their hopes were lost. It was too late now to go to Portjar. Following the rain cloud had put them too far out of the way. There was no hope of obtaining water now, except for the club. They all fully expected to die. There was one last small chance. They thought they might see the native patrol officer as he made his weekly trip through the desert. But when they found the tracks of his water truck in the sand, they knew he had already passed by and would not be back for another week. The tribe felt there was no hope and that only death awaited them. The 35 desert people held the death ceremony. Wailing, crying, they cut themselves with spears, with knives, with sharp stones. They cut their hair, they dug graves. The club did not wail nor bleed nor cut her long, lovely hair. Instead, she took great pains and time to paint her body in the holy water snake designs. She then sat by the fossilized track of the patrol water truck. The heat came on dry and oppressive in the early pre-dawn. Soon the sun spread out like a death blanket with a suffocating intensity. All the earth dried up, and everything on earth was dying of thirst. The smothering sun did not discourage the club. She did not give up when told as a young girl that it was absolutely impossible for a woman to become a sorcerer. And now she was the most powerful sorcerer in the Gibson Desert. She did not give up now. She would never give up. Her only thought, this club will bring water to her people. She sat and began the meditative ritual to bring water. 34 shallow graves filled up as the men, women, and children lay down to die, covering themselves with sand until 34 people became a group of 34 small mounds of sand. They buried themselves in shallow graves, buried themselves alive. The club sat in the silent desert, exerting all her strength, all the moisture baked out of her body, her lips cracked with the searing heat, her throat dried, her exhausted voice a whisper, but still she chanted, "Water is coming now." Her lips barely moved. The crawling hours passed. A speck appeared on the midday horizon, and the little speck was growing larger, approaching the gravesite, following the earlier truck tracks. The club, lost in her meditative trance, lost in seeing, sat immobile. Something approached, getting bigger, growing out of the distance. No one saw the trail of dust coming. It was a truck. And when the truck came close, when the noisy truck stopped on the tire tracks of the morning truck, next to the club, the noise woke the living dead in their graves. A native patrol officer following an earlier vehicle and making an unusual second delivery of water drove along the tracks of the earlier truck. The driver, wet with perspiration, sat up, amazed. when he saw what appeared to be a half-naked woman painted with sacred designs, sitting alone, sparkling in the liquid desert, sitting surrounded by a group of small mounds of sand. He came close to where the club sat, eyes moist, chanting in meditative ecstasy under the clear blue sky. He stopped his truck noisily, slashing the water, splashing. He was Aborigine himself, but he had never seen a woman painted with sacred designs. He was so shocked, he just sat in his truck and looked at the club. The 34 men, women, and children rose up from their individual graves, the sand of their graves in their hair and on their bodies, smiling at the astounded driver. First one and then another sat up in their graves. They were calling to one another, wiping their eyes, laughing, sand falling from their bodies. They rose up and walked slowly over to the truck where they laughingly asked the frightened driver for water. The Navy patrol officer froze, so frightened he couldn't move. And this made the people laugh even more as they approached the truck. The driver prayed to every god he knew as fast as he could. Finally, he came to his senses, seeing that he was in no danger, that the people were not really dead. The driver gave them water, filled their water bags, and got on his radio. Soon, other trucks were arriving to take the entire group to a mission reservation. The mission people gave clothes, water, housing, food, education, a new language, and a new religion. As the group of 34 loaded into the trucks, as they talked and wondered about this new life, the club looked at the truck through her monocle, then looked at the old man and said, "This truck will bring you to your grave, a different kind of grave, but a grave." With her water bag full, she began to walk out into the desert. Except for her backpack, which carried her pointing bones and her few belongings, except for her small bag of sacred objects tied round her neck, except for her bark shoes, she had nothing. But she walked proudly over the desert, as if she owned the desert. The officer watched her walking away and yelled, "Hey, where do you think you're going? Come back here." The old man answered for the club, who had not even looked around, who had kept on walking. She won't go with us. She's going somewhere else." "Maybe," said the old man, suddenly smiling, "maybe she is going to Potjai. Maybe she is even going to Manubi." He looked into the unbelieving eyes of the Navy patrol officer and, jumping down from the truck, said, "Maybe I will go with her." The old man grabbed his spear thrower and shield, his full water bag, and began following the club. The others looked at the club and the old man, who walked with endless pride and dignity, walking into the harsh, magnificent desert. The tribesmen looked at each other as first one, then two more, then five. Then all of the group jumped down from the truck with their full water bags and began to follow the club. The Native patrol officer tried to stop them, running after them, shouting, "But where are you going?" One of the newcomers answered, "We're going to chase away the flies at Manubi." All the Aborigines laughed and laughed, talking loud and joking as they followed the club into the desert.
Friends, that was Bakersfield author Gary Hill reading his story, "There's No One Now at Manubi, Only Flies." Quite a change of pace for us here on Valley Writers Read. Our writer tonight, Gary Hill, took us on a very unusual and dangerous trip way out into the heart of what appears to be the most absolutely barren, scorched, bone-dry desert you could ever imagine. It's called the Gibson Desert of Australia. All of us who live here in the San Joaquin Valley can appreciate being without water. We too have cycles of drought. As a matter of fact, we're probably in one right now. We too experience periods of hot weather, but from Gary's descriptions, our experiences aren't even remotely close to what the people who live in that far-off desert have had to endure for centuries. A group of Aborigines had seen a rain cloud off in the distance, and against the advice of the sorceress, whom they call the Club, followed it, hoping it would release some of its life-giving water. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. So that now the Club sits in the silent, sandy wilderness, exerting all her strength. All the moisture has been baked out of her body. Her lips are cracked from the searing heat. Her throat is dry, her exhausted voice gone. And still she chants. Water is coming now, her lips barely moving. The crawling hours pass slowly, and the group reaches a point when they prepare to die. They dig shallow graves in the sand and start to bury themselves. Well, as we heard, they see a tiny speck way off in the distance. It turns out to be a patrol officer making deliveries of water. For a while, they would drink the water, jump on the truck, which they knew would take them to the mission and to a secure supply of water, food, shelter, a new language, and a new life. But then, the sorceress told them, "This truck will bring you to your grave. A different kind of grave, but a grave nevertheless." So she took her water bag and her few possessions, and she headed out to the desert on her way to Part Yar, maybe even to Manubi. Her demeanor was so dignified, so prideful and resolute, that one by one all of them jumped off the truck to follow her. They would rather follow their own ways, the teachings and practices of their own ancestors, however difficult and risky, than be beholden to new masters, new ways, and new gods. It may be a part of the human survival instinct, but it's better to live with the evils we know about than to be faced with as yet unknown new ones. Here are some facts about the Great Gibson Desert. It's located in West Central Australia. It's about 85,000 square miles in size. By comparison, the whole state of California encompasses 158,000 square miles. This means that this desert is a little more than half the size of California. That's approximately an area all the way from the Mexican border to San Francisco, from the Pacific to the borders of Arizona and Nevada. Friends, Gary Hill grew up in East St. Louis. He studied at Southern Illinois University in the areas of chemistry and English. After school, he went to Australia for a time, where he met up with the Arunda Aborigines of Central Australia. Upon his return to the States, for a time he went to work at the Institute of Molecular Virology in St. Louis. Then he worked for 10 years at the City Water Division and for another 16 years for various water agencies in and around Kern County. Gary has published more than 20 poems, short stories, and essays. He also published a steady stream of technical articles having to do with water. We want to thank Gary for his unusual and thoughtful story. Hope we can get another one from him for next season. And so we come to the end of another segment of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read program again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our writer reader will be Hope Knisley. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.